You're now listening to Upon Further Review on the official Raiders Podcast Network. Here's your host, Eddie Pascal.
Raider Nation, Eddie Pascal and producer Trav, hello. Thank you for joining us once again for another edition of Upon Further Review. We're here back in the Beat Lab at 1220 Harbor Bay Parkway in Alameda, as we were earlier in the week. And it feels good to be home. I know I said that on Monday, but it feels good to be it feels nice to be back here in the lab, cooking, getting ready for free agency. As crazy as that sounds, we are less than a week out. How about that? We are less than a week away from the start of the 2019 NFL League year. Our significant others are weeping in the background. You cannot hear it. Our audio is not that good, but they are crying. They are very upset because we got a lot to do now, baby. Offseason is over. It's over. Dunzo. Thanks for playing. Hope you went on vacation. Hope you enjoyed those 3 days in Big Sur. It's time to go back to work. But I'm excited. I'm fired up. It's been a long offseason and a quick offseason at the same token, but it feels good. Ready to rock. We have a good episode today, a very strong episode. And I say that every week, but I do mean it. Feeling real good this week. We bring in, momentarily, the defensive line coach for your Oakland Raiders, Mr. Brinson Buckner. A man who, I will tell you this, has one of the strongest grips that I think I've ever experienced in my life. The strongest grip for you Raider diehards out there that I've encountered since I started working here is Austin Howard. Austin Howard was a mammoth of a man, played right tackle for the Silver and Black for a couple years, really nice guy, friend of the program. But dude, his hands, the first time I met him, I swear to you, I thought that some of the tiny bones in my hands had shattered and turned to dust, because my God, did that man have a grip. And Brinson Buckner, not far behind, but I did put on a strong face, so hopefully Coach didn't see me wincing in agony too much. But before we welcome Coach in, a couple of headlines real quick. Let's get into it. Franchise tag, the deadline passed the other day, and once again, and unsurprisingly, the Silver and Black did not exercise any of the three tags, the exclusive tag, non-exclusive, or the transition tag. Not a shocker there, but six teams did. Those six teams are the Atlanta Falcons, the division rival Kansas City Chiefs, they franchise Dee Ford, the Cowboys, the Texans, they like that franchise tag down there in the state of Texas, and then the Seahawks and the 49ers. They all use the tag. Historically, the tag, not something that we've used very often here in this building. 2012, I believe, the last time someone was franchise tagged. And 2008, if I'm not mistaken, according to our PR man, the great Will Kiss, the last time someone actually played under the franchise tag. And that, for you trivia monsters at home, Nnamdi Azikiwe, the last guy that played for the Silver and Black under the franchise tag. So yeah, something that doesn't happen very often, definitely more of a procedural thing at this point in the year, and I don't think there was any anticipation that Mike Mayock and Coach Gruden were going to use that tag, and shocker, they didn't. So a little bit of news of no news, if you will, on that front. But we get into it. Like I said, free agency starts on Wednesday. That's coming up in just a few days. That's crazy to say out loud. But in just a few days at 1 o'clock p.m. Pacific time, West Coast, Best Coast. That's when all the action gets underway. And you'll start to hear some things and stuff and rumblings from around the league starting on Monday when the tampering period opens. But as per the league rule, nothing becomes official until Wednesday afternoon at 1 p.m. You know that Joe Flacco trade, the one that happened 6 weeks ago, that everyone's talking about and everyone is acknowledged and the Broncos are planning and scheming with? Yeah, not official, but it will be in a couple days. So you'll see a lot of that kind of procedural stuff too on Wednesday afternoon. But we are going to have, as producer Trav reminds me, just a free agency, some programming for free agency. So we'll do the podcast regardless of whether or not the Raiders are active in free agency, if they sit back and wait a couple of days, see how the market unfolds. We will do a day one recap on Wednesday evening before we get out of here. So the league year will open at 1. There will be a plethora of moves around the NFL. And like I said, regardless of whether or not the Silver and Black are involved in those moves, we will break it down for you Wednesday night. And it's going to be exciting, man. I'm fired up. It's a fun time of the year. Hope is the name of the game. Hope, excitement, energy. Ready to get back to itness. I'm going to coin that word. Ready to get back to itness is kind of the sense and the feeling right now. But it's good. It'll be very good. And we're feeling good. We are ready to get to work. And another guy who's got a lot of work ahead of him with a lot of things to do in 2019 is Brenson Buckner. Like I said, the defensive line coach for your Oakland Raiders. And Coach Buckner joins us after stops in Tampa Bay, Arizona, and Pittsburgh, where he had a reputation for getting after the quarterback. And that is good news. We have talked at length, and I will try not to talk about it too much more, the struggles this team had getting after the quarterback in 2018. We know where those sack numbers were. We don't want them to be there any longer. We want them to go up, 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 and up. And hopefully Coach Buckner is the conduit to making that happen. So we sat down with Coach just a little bit ago, and I asked him, I said, Coach, why is this the right time for you to put on the silver and black?
I think it's the right time because, you know, after meeting with Coach Gruden and Paul Gunther, you know, the Raiders, you know, when Raiders are great, NFL is great. And meeting with John, he wanted to, his one thing about, he needed to help build the Raiders back to where everybody know and love the Raiders. And I think it's a perfect time for me as a position coach because a lot of times, rarely ever do you get a chance of a blank canvas, meaning young players hadn't had a lot of experience and you get to put your own take on it. You get to paint it the way you want to paint it. And so I think it was perfect. And I've been around some great coaches, so I think I'm suited for this now. I've got some great coaching from defensive guys, offensive guys, and I think I'm well suited for this moment right now.
You know, you mentioned meeting with Coach Gruden and Coach Gunther prior to taking the position and everything. What's that interview like when you're sitting down with Gruden and Gunther? Like, how does that whole thing work out?
I know you better be on your P's and Q's because Gruden is a football historian. You know, he bleeds, sweat, eats football. And it's very exciting, you know, having played against teams he's coached and saw the energetic guy he was on the sideline. Now I get a chance to sit face to face with him and in a meeting with him and Paulie. You know, they are deep into football. They want to know the basics, the nuts and the bolts of football. So it was actually a great interview because that's the way I was brought up in the game, is to respect it from the foundation up.
You know, you mentioned coming here, and part of the allure of the situation is you have kind of that blank canvas, right? But you look at that canvas and you got three young defensive linemen heading into year two. And I know that it's probably still pretty early in this process, but what are just your early thoughts about Mo Arden and PJ?
My first thoughts are they don't know what they don't know, which is a great, you know, because most rookies, either you're part of a good team and you play and you fit your part, or you're learning. These guys were thrown into the fire early. So a lot of stuff they did, they just went off natural ability and what made them good. And so, you know, I'm getting the guys that sort of, they've tasted the bad side of football, you know, learning, you know, oh, what this block is and what's coming here. Man, you know, you look at it, P.J. Hall, who was a guy that I had in on a 30 visit when he was coming out of college, you know, great get off, athletic, you know, jumped on the scene, run a great 40 time. But you look at his production in college, he's always been productive and he played multiple positions. Maurice Hurst, who I thought interior D-line wise was probably one of the top three players in the draft last year. Unfortunately, you know, he had the medical incident that got cleared. Thank God for that. But, you know, he plays hard. He plays with passion. And Arden Key, as a kid that's originally from Atlanta, Georgia, you know, you watch at LSU. You know, he's leading them in sacks one year. He gets big. He don't play. He has his ups and downs. But you watch him play last year, and you can see what makes him special. So all those guys together, you know, you build certain positions. You can build a certain bond when you go through stuff. And, you know, they went through the briar patch last year as young guys having to play. But one thing I see that all of them have, they have a passion for the game. And that's one thing I can't coach, or anybody can coach, is passion and a want to. So now it's up to me to come in and just tie it all together.
I'm curious, for those guys in particular, I guess any rookie or first-year guy, what's the hardest part of that transition from the college game to the NFL, especially on the defensive line?
The hardest part is the speed of the game and techniques. You know, the speed of the game is so fast. You know, a lot of people like to look at, well, he ran a fast 40, he did this. But when you get to the NFL, everybody is supposed to be there. You know, no knock on any colleges. You can wake up one morning and fall out of bed and play against a guy and be able to get four sacks because you're just naturally better than he is, talent-wise and athletic-wise. But when you get to the NFL, everybody's good. And so the speed happens so fast, technique is on point. And so for a defensive lineman, you got to understand it's not about how fast you are, how strong you are, how big you are. You got to start the small things. You got to be able to think the game from the top down, you know, because everybody has athletic ability, but now you got to be able to slow the game down. So that's hard for young guys because it's like going into a country and somebody throwing you trying to teach you a whole nother language, and you got to regurgitate it every Sunday in front of millions of people.
You know, we talked about the three young guys for a good reason, too, and obviously they're going to be the future of this defensive line going forward. But I'm curious, do you think it's important the way that you build an NFL roster to have a veteran presence along with those guys? Or is it kind of a situation where you're like, all right, the young guys that were thrown in the fire last year, it's time to ride again?
Well, it would be a perfect situation if you have a veteran guy that can help those guys. You know, to be sort of like a coach on the field, because sometimes a coach and young players can just keep clicking heads, but you got to have that buffer zone. That's where a veteran guy comes in, and that's great, but everybody's not afforded that way. So one of those young guys have to grow up. All of them have to grow up. What it is all about, for me as a coach, you know, you got to go in there and you got to think about all the things that encompass being a defensive lineman. You know, stance, technique, footwork, knowing the ins and outs of your opponent, knowing how to play the game off the field, so it translates on the field, and then also just really taking care of your body and make sure everything is pointing toward the direction of being great on the field.
You know, the story surrounding this defensive line last year, and really the defense as a whole, was the inability to get to the quarterback, right? And we've talked about a lot that getting pressure on the quarterback just wasn't there. But I'm curious, as a guy from the outside looking in and with all your kind of football expertise, can sack numbers in and of themselves be a little deceiving about the health of a defense?
Yes, I really believe they are, because sack is not but a tackle of the quarterback, but everything has to come together. You got to put yourself in a predicament to take advantage of those opportunities. Coverage has to be right. Your rush has to be right. The quarterback might have to hold the ball a little bit longer. Somebody has to move him. So you just want to put yourself in those tight predicament. You'll never, ever hear me preach sack numbers. I just don't do it. I preach the fundamentals of football, and I'm a firm believer if you stop the run, your sack numbers get the chance to go up, because you want to be in third and seven or more. You know, and that comes with stopping the run, because you can talk about sacks, but if a guy running the ball down your throat, you really ever gonna get rarely ever gonna get a chance, no, to do it. So they can't be inflated. Deacon Jones told me one time, he's like, he had been a big proponent of sacks. He always preached sacks, they didn't count his sacks. And he said he sat down one day and was like, I played 1,100 plays in a season, and I worry about 16 plays I want to throw a parade for. What about the other chances I had to affect the game? And so when you look at it in that scale, the sacks is a small number, but it's a big part of the game. But the greatest pass rush you ever have is a pass coverage, and the greatest pass coverage you can have is a pass rush. So you got to have two things working hand in hand with one another on the same page to have some success.
In reference to the pass rush, we talked to Mike when we were in India at the combine, and one thing that he said that kind of stood out with me, he goes, you know, nowadays, because I talk to quarterbacks all around the league, and they said that the rush up the middle is the hardest thing for them to deal with. And I'm curious that I remember when we were talking about it earlier, when we were growing up watching football and all that, it didn't seem like there was such an emphasis on that push up the middle. It was the edge rushers were the guys who always got to the quarterback. Has that been a bit of a philosophical change the past couple of years? When you look at guys like Aaron Donald who can get after the quarterback, seeing those big fellas in the middle who are primarily there to stop the run, but they can get after the quarterback?
Yes, that's a big part, because like you alluded to, outside rushers were so great. So what did offensive linemen do? They morphed to taller, bigger guys on the outside to negate that, and quarterbacks began to step up in the pocket, because you normally just had run stoppers in there. Now you want to get the pressure in the middle of the pocket, because now the game is so fast. Everything is running, crossing across the field. You want to take away passing lanes. And also, if the quarterback steps up, you want to be able to distract them. So the push up the middle is great, because you get guys like Tom Brady, for instance, greatest he is, I think the greatest quarterback probably ever to play the game. One thing he struggled with is pressure in his face. The shorter quarterbacks, the Russell Wilsons, the Drew Breeses, they hate pressure in their face. They can feel it from the outside. They want to feel comfortable stepping up in the pocket. When you can disrupt the middle of that pocket, it causes havoc for quarterbacks.
I haven't really thought about it like that, but I'm now headed into the draft season, and another thing Mike said, and he preached it, he goes, you know, this defensive line class is the best to come out in a decade. It's the best I've seen in 10 years. Not to put you on the spot too much, but when you, from what you saw at the combine, were you kind of encouraged by the crop of guys coming out this year?
Yes, it's, like I said before, with the way the game is going, being more pass than run, of course defenses are going to move toward that way. So you have a great crop of guys coming out inside and outside. And you know, it was great to just see those guys, to see these big, long guys that can run. And now even seeing big guys in the middle that can run. So you can see the evolution of the defensive line starting to turn around, because you look at a lot of those guys did not go into college as defensive linemen. You know, they went in as linebackers and other positions and grew, but they're more athletic. And you can still see the athleticism when they're out there doing the D-line drill. So that's a great feeling to be a D-line coach.
I'm nowhere close to 300 pounds, and I'm telling you, I'm not running a sub-540. I promise you that. But the way that the league has become, it seems like it's become so pass-happy the past couple years. Does that force you as a coach to kind of change the way that you coach up your guys? Or is for you, will it always be coming back to the fundamentals and doing the little things right and things like that?
It's always going to come back to fundamentals for me. I'm not going to jump on board. Oh, it's going to pass. Let's just get to the passing. And then they run me out of town because we're giving up 200 yards rushing the game. So you got to stick with the fundamentals, because like I said, getting to the quarterback is a great feeling, because those guys get paid to protect the quarterback, but you can't forget the other fundamentals of football, playing good technique, being gap control, being able to stop the run. Most of the time, offenses are smart. They're not allowing you to rush the pass on third down, because they know defenses can run out different packages, come with crazy different blitzes. So a lot of the times, your best chance to rush the pass is going to come on first and second down when you're thinking run, but it's play action pass or somebody's taking the shot. So you got to take care of the fundamentals, put yourself in a predicament, and just when you get a chance to get there, you got to maximize that opportunity.
You know, you look at this division, this AFC West, and obviously Mahomes and Phillip Rivers now, and a guy like Joe Flacco coming in. What kind of challenges do those three guys present to the defensive line, especially knowing that you got to play them twice a year?
Oh, you got Super Bowl winner Flacco. You got Rivers, who's a Hall of Famer, and you got the new young gun. It causes a lot, because, you know, they are the head of the bodies. Now, you watch Patrick Mahomes play from a distance, and you see him do things. He can run. He can throw from all different type of angles. Phillip Rivers will frustrate you as a pass rusher, because he doesn't hold on to the ball. He has a quick release, and Flacco is just a cool guy. It's called Joe Cool for a reason. So as a D-line coach, you know they're going to pose problems, because they are what's going to make it click. This is a quarterback lead. Let's not get this twisted. Quarterbacks are more protected than anybody. They're the highest paid, and the game is built around them. And so if you want to win, you got to affect the other team's quarterback. So as a D-line coach, you know, you sit there, and they pose problems all over the place, but it's your job. Try to make sure your guys can step up to the challenge, and that's what I'm here to do.
For a defensive line coach, what's the one thing that a player, a quarterback in particular, does that'll keep you up at night?
Well, a guy that can move the pocket, a guy like Mahomes that can throw off. Like most of the time, if you say, well, I can get this guy running, he can't throw from this angle. You get him running away from his throwing arm, you got him. Well, this guy runs away from his throwing arm and jumps up and throw the ball 70 yards back down the field. So that keeps you up at night, because you got to find ways to, now I got to move, but now I got to get to him. And you have to sit there and you try to break down everything to put your guys in the situation to get them the knowledge where they can be successful. But a guy like Mahomes that can throw from different angles, can throw out of the pocket, can throw in the pocket, can step up, can bail, can make something happen with his feet, you know, that's scary.
You know, I know we have so much longer to go in this offseason before we even get to training camp and start thinking about week one, but when you think about your first season as a Raiders coach, what are your expectations for this year? Like, what do you want to accomplish in 2019?
My expectations for us to be great. You know, I grew up a Raider fan. I grew up knowing what Raider football looked like, and I know when Raider football is at its best, you can look at that defensive line and tell the difference. And so my goal is for us to be the best we can be every Sunday we step out down the field, every day we step into the meeting room, every day we step into the weight room, you got to set a culture. So my expectation is to set the culture that's going to help us grow into being the best unit we can be. And whether that spend extra time in the room, film, anything I need to do, I'm going to do it. Well, I'm going to ask my guys to give the same thing. Because other than religion and your family, it's got to be Raider football. Because I know what it is to come here and play when this team is hitting on all cylinders and that defensive line is rolling off the ball and, you know, that nation goes crazy. So our goal is to be the best defensive line in the NFL and hopefully help us be the best team in the NFL.
Who are the Raiders that you remember watching as a kid? I'm curious.
Oh, come on. You're talking about Howie Long. You're talking about Lester Hayes. You're talking about Skip Thomas, Dr. Death, George Atkinson. You're talking about they called me the assassin. You know, all of them. Chester McLaughlin, who's my college roommate, my best friend, he played on this team. He played here. You're looking at Kenny King, running back. I remember Kenny King catching the touchdown versus the Eagles in the Super Bowl down in New Orleans. Cliff Branch. You're talking about who else I want to say? Mike Haynes, probably one of the greatest cornerbacks of all time. Him and Lester Hayes made to be the greatest combination of DBs to ever play this game. Otis Sistrunk, who is from my hometown, was like a godfather to me. I remember sitting down, him coming back, talking to my dad, telling the stories. I'm sitting there like, wow, this guy just played in the Super Bowl. Didn't even go to college, University of Mars. Come on, you know. And then the greatest Raider of all time, you know, that's Al Davis. You know, that's Mr. Davis. So I grew up a Raiders fan. So me being in this building is like a make-a-wish for me. I get to live it every day I walk into the building. You know, Raiders fan. I was once disqualified from a state track meet for not taking off my Raiders shirt, throwing the shot put. I refused to take it off and got disqualified.
That's it.
So that just lets you know. And I was the best thrower in the state. So that just lets you know how much the Raiders mean to me.
I see why Coach Gruden likes you, though. You know your history, man. It's not service level for you.
Oh, it's that. I grew up, like I said, I grew up a football fan before I ever got a chance to play it. And the Raiders was one of those teams that just caught my eyes. The commitment to excellence, as Mr. Davis would always say, you just watch it. Marcus Allen reversing field. You know, Bo Jackson. Come on, who else? You know, I'm friends with Ethan Horton, who was a draft choice here. John Madden. You know, it's just so much. Willie Brown, who I met Willie Brown coming out of college. You know, Willie Brown, just the history. You know, coming here from the Broncos, if I'm not mistaken, intercepting the ball in the Super Bowl. And, you know, it's just Lyle Alzado. I can just go on and on.
You can. I appreciate that immensely, though.
You know, about these guys. But I feel blessed to be here because this is a historic franchise. This is one of the pillars of the NFL. And for me to have a chance and John Gruden and the Raider organization to trust me to be a part of this rebuild, to get this where the Raiders need to be, why wouldn't I want to be here?
Couldn't have said it better myself. So I have one non-football question for you. I'm curious. How you're kind of in some senses the new guy on this coaching staff. How's the camaraderie going with the other coaches so far?
The camaraderie is going good. I get along with anybody.
I can tell.
I talk to a rock if it'll listen long enough. You know what I mean? But it's been great. It's football. This is what I imagine a coaching staff being like in pure football. Because you know John is energetic. It's football, football, football. You know, it's all the time. And the guys that he has brought together are great. And the guys welcome me with open arms. And that's what I want to be, because every morning I come in here, I'm trying to build myself to the point where I don't want them guys to ever look at me and say, why did we hire this guy here? No, that's the kind of pressure that I put on myself. And those guys that helped me, offensive guys, defensive guys, battling Coach Cable when I was coaching in Arizona, him in Seattle, you know, seeing him now getting to coach with him. You know, those guys have just opened their hands like I always been here, because I think they really feel he was probably born to be a Raider. It just took him a while to get the costume on.
I like that. Well, after this, I'm pretty sure I can give you a couple reps on third down. Shoot. Well, Coach, we appreciate your time. We'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you very much.
A genuine, sincere, humble thank you to Coach Buckner for swinging through. Man, that was a lot of fun. I'm serious. I'm fired up, though. I think that if Coach gave me, if he said, Eddie, I need you to give me 10 reps on third down. I need you to get the quarterback. I'd give that man my heart. I'd give him everything in me. I would try my hardest, and I would bring Patrick Mahomes down behind the line of scrimmage. Excited to see what he does with those young Bulls this year. Excited. Very excited. We transition from Coach Buckner into, as I shuffle my papers and ambient noise, our still sponsored list segment. So please, everyone out there that's listening, please tweet at us. Try to encourage us in this dark time. Tell us who you want to be a sponsor of the segment. But the fact remains, Victory Formation brought to you by nobody. Eddie Pascal, producer Trav, Marvin Gaye, and Chardonnay Martin, our senior esports correspondent, junior draft analyst, and a man who, after 2 weeks of being happy, is quite angry once again. What an entrance. The heavy sigh.
What an embarrassing week.
Yeah, you've taken a lot of L's this week.
The Lakers are in free fall. Madrid has lost, I believe, four home matches in a row now. We've been bounced from Champions League. And to make matters better or worse, Jose Mourinho is going to be our manager.
So for a little backstory for those who don't know, I feel like everyone who listens to the pod knows Kyle's our resident Lakers fan. In addition to being a Lakers fan, Kyle is a pretty devout Real Madrid fan. As he said, they were bummed from the Champions League. And if there's one thing that Kyle, if there's one person that has really taken the brunt of Kyle's rage the past couple weeks, it is Jose Mourinho, the now disgraced manager, former manager of Manchester United. And Kyle has really gone out of his way to take shots at this gentleman, really for no reason. And now, mere hours ago, Kyle is informed from our boss, Raider Vito, diehard Juventus supporter, that Mourinho will now be at the helm of Kyle's club, and to say he was devastated would be a bit of an understatement.
I fell to the floor. I collapsed. My knees buckled, and everything, the world that I once knew, has crashed around me.
It really was pretty humiliating.
It's bad.
And the best part of this was is that Vito and I have a Slack channel where we talk about mostly soccer things, and he messaged you saying, you know, with the news, and you, I believe, were indisposed at the moment, so you didn't see it till you got back to your desk.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm at my desk and Vito's in his office, and we realize that you haven't seen the message yet. So what we saw was the genuine raw emotion that literally took the life out of your body.
There were no theatrics there. That was all pure, genuine emotion. None of my teams are successful, Eddie. All I have is the draft. That's all I have. That's all I have.
All right. Well, we'll get right into it then. Speaking of the draft, got back from Indy a couple of days ago. What a blessing to that city. Big shout out to all our friends in Indy. I got to ask you, because I got a good laugh out of this today, as I know you did as well. A gentleman who works for NFL.com, his name's Chad. You remember what Chad's last name is, who put the mock draft out?
It's Reuter, Reader.
Chad Reuter. Chad put out a mock draft, and
it's laughable.
Yeah, I don't want to shame Chad. I'm sure he's got a family and he's got bills to pay, and he's got a mortgage. I get that. But Chad put out a mock draft that made me raise an eyebrow. And as our junior draft analyst, he had us picking, I have to ask your opinion, had us taking Drew Lock at 4. And then I believe, if I'm not mistaken, a tackle and a tight end.
Yeah, he had us
at
taking,
24 and 27.
He had us taking Noah Fant from Iowa at 24.
Who's good player.
Who
good
looks
player.
Great. Who genuinely looks great.
Probably the best tight end in this class, right?
Him and TJ Hawkinson, also from Iowa, yes. But then at 27, he had us taking a guard. So you look at the Raiders and you think, wow, it's a defense needy team and this is a defense loaded draft. I'm going to go all offensive picks in this mock draft.
Yeah, Chad, baby, we have an open line if you want to come in and explain yourself on the pod. We've issued this decree to several people. No one's taken us up on it so far, but Chad, you can be the first. If you want to come on, be our guest, explain to us your thought process behind the mock draft. We would love to have you on. But yeah, very confusing. I think confusing is the main word that comes to mind for me.
Especially after the combine. The combine revealed a lot.
I feel like we collectively felt we were at a pretty good place for what this team was going to do, what this team needed, what we wanted this team to do. And when we got back from Indy, and Chad just... I don't know what restaurant in Indy Chad was hanging out at, but if they got... I want some of whatever Chad's got. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I'm glad he's not in our war room. I'll say that.
One thing I'm interested in, and we've kind of talked about it a little bit in the studio, is DK Metcalf. And this man, an Adonis, truly just a physique of incredible proportions. My God. But I saw one mock that had us taking him at 4.
Yeah, you can thank our good friend from The Athletic, Vic Tafer, for that prediction.
Big blessings to Vic.
An
actual friend of the program, but go on.
Vic, I respect your opinion immensely, but I'm going to have to strongly disagree with you on that one. I don't think DK Metcalf is a 4th overall pick. I don't think that he will... Yeah, I don't know. I think he's got all the physical skills, obviously, to be a dominant player, but... Last week at the Combine, I was speaking with Dane Brugler and another member of The Athletic and Brian Broaddus, the Dallas Cowboys draft guy. And
just three evaluators really stick getting their heads together.
And Dane Brugler was just going in on how DK Metcalf had a terrible three-cone drill time, terrible shuttle time. He was saying that, I mean, it's everything that you worry about with DK Metcalf because you note his size, his strength. But that makes him so boxy that he's just a straight line runner, right? And if this man is having worse three cone drill times than Tom Brady did when he was in the combine, that's alarming.
Yeah. And I, you know, they're different guys. It's different years, different positions, different sides of the ball, even. But I don't want to harken back to this. But I think it's fair to say DK Metcalf was a combine all star.
Sure.
Right? Can we all agree with that? Everyone sitting in this room? He was a combine all star.
For sure.
And that's to take away nothing from DK, nothing at all. Another guy who was a combine all-star, Obi Melifonwu. And that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, that's all you can say.
That's all you can say. Now, I'm certainly not implying that DK is going to have the type of career trajectory that Mr. Melifonwu did during his time in Silver and Black. But I'm simply bringing up the fact that there's more that goes into a full evaluation, a full picture of a guy than just how fast he is, how strong he is, and how quick he can, you know, run the 40,
Yeah, DK Metcalf is the perfect example of somebody who embodies the hype, right? Like, everybody's focused on DK because of his 40 time and how many bench press reps he had. 27, he ran a 4.33. Both impressive, right?
Yeah.
But it all comes back. I mean, people get too caught up in it because if you look at his stats in college, it's a production-based league at the NFL level.
Sure is.
His stats in college, not impressive. His overall combine experience was good, you know, but his anything outside of the bench press and the 40-yard dash is not anything to look twice at.
Yeah, and I mean, outside of the combine numbers and all that stuff, you know that one thing that I really put a premium on is production.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to see out of guys that you're going to take top five, first round, really, I want to see guys that produced at a high level in college. I don't want to see a guy that had four catches for 32 yards.
If
they're going in the first round. Now, if you're going to take a flyer on a guy who got hurt, had a bunch of coaching changes, some weird stuff happened, he was really good for a stretch, and he couldn't put it all together for a year. Look, that's what the second and third day of the draft are for, probably the third day. But at a guy, and we've talked about it so much, at that number four pick, and I don't know if it's fair enough for me to really kind of look at number four different than I do 24 and 27, just because at the end of the day, they're all first-round picks. But at four, you got to get a guy who comes in day one and contributes.
100%.
You absolutely have to. And I'm not saying that DK Metcalf can't be this guy, but I'm just saying, if you think of all the guys that are going to be available at four, I just don't
reach.
Know.
Don't reach.
Now, if Mr. Metcalf wants to wear the silver and black, and he's sitting at 24. Pick up that phone, baby. Bring him home. But I just at number four, you have to be 100% sold on that guy. At number four, the person you pick is going to be a cornerstone of your franchise for if everything goes the right way the next decade.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot have any questions about this guy at number four.
No, and there's so many other talented wide receivers that you can select.
And I know
later.
You're high on Harry, right?
N'Keal Harry out of Arizona State put up the same amount of bench press reps that DK Metcalf did. A better route runner, one would say. Had an overall great combine performance. And he's projected to go late first round. So you can pick him up then. You can pick up DK Metcalf's teammate, A.J. Brown. You can pick Paris Campbell out of Ohio State. There's all these guys, you just go down the list, that are all worth drafting. And you can still use that fourth overall pick on a defensive player, which you desperately need. You know, I don't see the point in taking Metcalf at four. There's Rashawn Gary. There's Quinnen Williams. There's Josh Allen.
Who I've become quite infatuated with since the draft process has gotten underway. A big Quinnen Williams guy, especially in talking with Mike Mayock and with Coach Buckner earlier, talking about how important it is to have pressure up the middle. And I'm just thinking about it in terms of purely just real world what is so. The big guys in the middle can get to the quarterback faster than your edge guys. That's just space and numbers and the universe. So if we could just – you got Big Mo – you got Jelly. I mean, you got a lot of pieces on that inside of the line, on the interior of the line, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, baby. Throw Big Quinnen in there and let him eat. The big man is famished. Give him some Oreos and gear him up and tell him to go get the quarterback.
He did have, what, four double-stuffed Oreos before his combine
drills?
Yeah, that's impressive. And he ran a 4.8 at 300 pounds. That's nuts.
That is sickening.
Yeah, he's an athletic freak for sure, but I would love to see Gruden and Mayock go defensive line at four. Maybe another defensive lineman at 24, or go linebacker at 24, whether Devin Bush is still on the board or Devin White. I doubt Devin White will be there still. And then go wide receiver at 27.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%.
Use all three picks.
Yeah, use the picks, baby. You got that capital for a reason. Speaking of wide receivers, if you will, and let's put this disclaimer out there. Kyle and Travis and I don't know anything that you guys don't know about the Antonio Brown situation. We're not here to pretend that we have some inside track and we're going to yada, yada, yada. We're just going to talk about it strictly in terms of hypothetically, because look, the reality of it is if you turn on ESPN or NFL Network that the Raiders and Antonio Brown have been linked. I don't think there's anything wrong in saying that. That is what's so. I don't know. Now, who knows if that's true or not? But that's what the old TV is saying. So I'm curious, Kyle, and I know you and I have a little differing views on this situation. I'm curious for producer Trav's take, but it's so much more complicated than a yes or no question. But AB on the Raiders roster in 19, do you like it?
Yeah, I mean, why? But at what cost?
That's what it'll always come back to for me, and let's be real. Antonio Brown is going to the Hall of Fame. He is the best wide receiver or the second best wide receiver on a bad day in the NFL right now. The dude is a monster. But for me, you have to give up something to get him. That's just the situation that we find ourselves in. The Steelers have him under contract. Antonio does not want to be there anymore. The Steelers are not dummies and are not going to ship him away for nothing. They realize they have a pretty nice bargaining chip, and they want something back. Now, would I send off the number four pick for AB? Absolutely not. Would I send off 24? I'd think about it. Realistically, for me, I would be comfortable sending a second back to Pittsburgh for AB.
I just don't know if you'll get that. I don't think you can offer a second and get AB back. I just don't. I mean, in a wonderful fantasy world, I think that would be awesome, right? That's definitely worth it. I think you have to give up 27 in the first in order to get him, but that's just because, I mean, the man's production speaks for itself, regardless of the fact that he's 31 years old. That's the issue for me.
For me, the issue is less his age, and it's more what you're going to get back. What you're going to have to give up to get him here. That's what it's going to come down to for me.
Yeah, but
I mean, we were looking at Jerry Rice's numbers yesterday, you and I. Jerry Rice was putting up 1,000-yard seasons when he was 54.
Nobody else has ever been Jerry Rice, though.
That's a fair point, but I guess the closest that you'll probably see to Jerry Rice, at least in this generation of NFL football, is probably Antonio Brown.
You could say that, sure, but you wouldn't be as upset about what we'd give up if he was younger, right? Because if you're giving up a first-round pick for a 26, 27-year-old as opposed to a 31-year-old, that's a complete, way different scenario, right?
Yeah.
The thing that I don't understand is that he's also said that whatever team he goes to next, he wants to restructure his deal. What does that imply? You know, like what? How does that end up?
Yeah, I mean, he's gonna want more money. He's gonna want to be under Like I get that. I mean, he wants
mad money. He wants guaranteed money.
Yeah, he wants guaranteed money, which is, I mean, I think we're speaking the same language. We're saying that our hiccups on doing this are probably the same. I mean, I don't really care that he has a loud personality. I don't care that he has a bleached mustache. I don't care about any of that. To me, it's what are you going to give up to bring this guy in? And just in terms of the age, quote-unquote, conversation, producer Trev, as our resident Raiders historian on this podcast, I mean, you look at Jerry Rice and Tim Brown when they were here. How old were they when they were putting up 1,000-yard seasons?
Well, Rice was probably – well, Tim Brown, I mean, we drafted him, what, 88, so – he was here till I think 2004, 2003.
Yeah, I was going to say three or four, somewhere around there.
I mean, you have the top two receivers of all time, in my opinion. Well, one for sure, and then you could say Brown.
Sure.
Two or three, right?
But they were putting up big yardage in their late 30s.
Yeah, game changers.
Jerry Rice had over 1,000 yards when the man was 40.
That's sickening. Jerry Rice could still probably
catch 1,000 yards, you know?
I would love to see that with a single earring still.
Oh, man. I would love nothing more. But as we talk about, everything's cyclical. The single earring is back. It's in, baby.
I mean, Neymar yesterday in Champions League had
the double dangles.
Double dangling earrings.
Yeah. I don't know, though. For me, I know we're kind of just going around and around. I don't care that he's going to be turned, what, 31, right? AB's 30.
He is 31.
He's currently 31, so he'll be turning 32 in some point in 2019. I don't really care about that. You know, you look at, you know, he isn't a defensive lineman or an offensive lineman, someone who's taking a beating, you know, snap in and snap out.
No, but what makes Antonio Brown good right now? Like, what are his best assets? Why is he one of the best wide receivers in the NFL?
I would say speed and route running.
What happens when you get older? What do you lose?
Yeah, speed.
There you go, right?
I don't think that AB or any NFL wide receiver, unless you're the second coming of Jeremiah Rice, is looking for an 8-year deal.
No,
right?
But even if let's say you keep him 4 years until he's 35, you don't think there's going to be a drop off at some point? And when you can use that first round pick on a who knows if you'll hit on a good wide receiver with the 27th pick or 24th or 4th, whatever pick it is, right?
Yeah, it's kind of that argument of you have a known commodity versus something, you know, what's in the box. You
sure,
know?
It's a risk either way because you draft a rookie and maybe he's a stud. And then you can have him for X amount of time where compared to Antonio Brown, you trade for him. And the risk is, sure, you know he's a stud right now. He's elite right now. But how much longer will he be elite?
That's a million-dollar question, right?
Exactly. So it's a gamble either way. I don't know. I mean, I get what you're saying. You're more – it's less of a risk if you take Antonio Brown because you know what you're getting. But still, for how long?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a tough one. It's a decision that I'm glad I do not have to make. I'll say that. But – I mean, you look at a guy like AB, and he single-handedly can kind of change the face of your offense, right? He changes what you do offensively, you know? And I don't know. That's pretty exciting. Like I said, I don't know if it's going to happen. If it does, it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I mean, I don't think it'll have a – you know, we'll go on. We'll soldier on. But
let me ask you one last question to add to this.
Sure.
We all know, everybody in the pod studio, that Derek Carr loves to spread the ball around.
He does. Right? It's one of the best things about Derek's game.
Equal parties, throws to Jared Cook, throws to Jordy, throws to Seth.
Loves throwing to the running back, too.
Absolutely. There's no – he's not honing in on one guy all the time.
Yeah.
Isn't that why you'd kind of want AB, though? You'd want him to be the premier guy that's going to see all the targets, regardless of whether he's double covered?
Yes and no. I mean, as you know, one of my big things is, and I'm not going to pretend like I'm a football guy, but you look at AB, and if you throw him out there, look, and Gruden is one of the premier offensive minds in the NFL, so he'll figure out a way to get it done. But I think just really dumbing it down, is AB going to be your de facto number one? Absolutely. But, like, you can't just go over to him over and over and over again, regardless of the cover. Like, what would be great about a guy like AB is that he gives guys like Jordy more time to eat. He gives Marcel Aitman more chances to get balls. Jalen out of the backfield. I mean, if you're a defense, he's one of the dozen guys, 12, 15 guys in the NFL that if you're a defensive coordinator, you have to scheme around.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're trading for him and we need a playmaker, let him be the playmaker. Throw to him 8-10 times a game because that's what you went out to get him for. If you're going to get him and bring him in just to be a decoy, what's the point?
Yeah,
And just to help other guys eat, what's the point?
Yeah, well, I think, okay, let's put it this way. I think on 3rd and 7 with the game on the line, I think the ball is going to Antonio Brown regardless of what the coverage dictates, right? I think that's fair.
Sure.
Isn't that what you bring a guy like him in for? Even if, you know, he has 4 catches up to that point, but you bring him in for that 3rd and 7. You bring him in for that 4th and 2. Like, those are the moments you sign AB for.
Sure. I'm just throwing out questions.
I know. Rage Kyle today.
I mean,
and this Mourinho thing has really gotten you
it's gotten me in the
up
dark
in arms.
Games, yeah.
Before we wrap up, Kyle, real quick, because we will be getting more and more into this as the weeks go on, but just since it's fresh, coming off of our experience in Indy, for you, did one of the defensive linemen kind of separate themselves from the herd a little bit in Indy, or are you still kind of, because I know going into there, you had that 4 to 5 guy grouping of like your good guys at 4. Anyone do anything to create a little separation?
Great question. Truthfully, I feel like I didn't see anyone in particular separate themselves or show anything that we didn't already expect, mm-hmm. which I'm taking as a positive, though. Because if anything, regardless of whatever defensive lineman you pick at 4, or whether you trade up or down or whatever,
sure.
of those 5 guys, right, Montez Sweat, Rashawn Gary, Nick Bosa, Quinnen Williams, Josh Allen, I would be happy, overjoyed, if we were to draft any of those guys. I think they've all proven that they would be a fit, and it would be a safe pick that you would benefit from, where they're going to be a stud. I'm confident that after watching them all at the combine, watching their tape, looking at their numbers in college, that they would be guys that you'd want to draft, regardless of who it is.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with you 99%. For me, in just talking with people in Indy and talking to our friends at the Cowboys, the one guy that I really like is Quinnen Williams.
Sure, he definitely helped himself. Looks great.
He does. I think he would help this defensive line immensely. I think he's a guy that I'm excited to see more of over the coming weeks. But, yeah, I mean, you brought up a great point. I mean, in terms of that top-tier group, I mean, there's no bad options. It's kind of your Daniel Jeremiah described it to Travis and I as kind of your it's a flavor draft, he called it. So it's, you know, there's all these great, you know, these great defensive linemen. It is, what is this coaching staff like? What is this guy, you know? So mm-hmm. you kind of have your pick of the litter there, but
that's a good
stat at 4.
That's a good way to describe it. Just whatever flavor is your choice. Yeah, I agree with that. They're all going to be good.
Variety is the spice of life, as they say. Going to Flavor Town. Well, maybe we'll get Guy to come in. A Guy, Mr. Fieri, a pretty devout member of the nation. Maybe he can come in and throw us a little cashola and take us to Flavor Town. But we're out of here. I felt good about that, Trav. You feel good about that? I felt pretty strong about today.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, feeling good, feeling strong, ready to rock. So, as I said, we are back on Wednesday evening, the night, I guess technically NFL New Year's Day night? I don't know. That's wordy, but you get it. Wednesday night, look for a new podcast. We'll break down everything from day one of free agency, all the exciting things, all the things that surprised us, shocked us, scared us, everything under the world, under the moon. So, Freddie Pascal, KMM, producer Trav, Coach Buckner, until Wednesday, Raider Nation, enjoy the weekend, rest up, and we will catch you next week on Upon Further Review.
Thank you for listening to Upon Further Review on the official Raiders Podcast Network.